This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blumke. And you're listening to the podcast for friendlyatheist.com.
Our guest tonight is Fred Clark, a progressive evangelical Christian blogger, better known as Slacktivist. He's one of those Christians who defies all the stereotypes atheists tend to have of Christians. He's for gay marriage, he's critical of church leaders, and he's constantly frustrated with what his quote-unquote tribe does in the name of Jesus. Full disclosure, Fred writes for Pathos, the same network on which you could find my Friendly Atheist blog. Fred, thanks for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
Good. Did I get all that right in the introduction there?
I think so. Yeah. I'd sign at the bottom of that. Sure.
Great. So, Fred, let's talk about the name Slacktivist. I really like it. What's the origin of that name?
The origin of that, back in the 90s, my friend Dwight and I were doing seminars at Cornerstone Music Festival, which is was a really kind of cool, hippie, weird music festival, Christian evangelical music festival run by the Jesus People USA.
Our type of people.
like the hippie commune in Chicago.
Yeah.
And, that's actually right next to my apartment.
We went out there every summer. You know them?
They have like a skate shop right down the street from my apartment in Uptown. It's very strange.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So you know where I live now.
Yeah, they're an odd bunch.
Yeah, but, the Christian skater group.
But the festival was just a great party every summer, and Dwayne and I did seminars out there, and one year we were doing it on, kind of in reaction to, at the time it was the early 90s, and people were writing all the same stuff about Generation X then that they're writing about millennials now, you know.
It's always old people complaining about the young people, basically.
Kids these days.
It's the same thing. I'm really trying to resist ever turning into the old person who writes that article. But I guess at some point it just happens. It's like hair in your nose. It just comes with old age. But we were tired of that, and we were tired of the way the word slacker was being used all the time because of the Richard Linklater movie. But it made all of the elders just sound to us like the vice principal from Back to the Future, you know? You're a slacker, McFly. And so we decided we would focus on the kind of activism that young people were doing, which there was some really exciting stuff being done by these supposedly apathetic Gen Xers. And we called it slacker activism. And at some point, Dwight shortened that to slacktivism, which I said sounded terribly cheesy. It was an awful word.
And catchy.
But I've since come around to thinking, hey, it's actually kind of a cool word.
Yeah.
So
anyone who reads anyone who reads your website may be surprised, because a lot of the things that you write about evangelical Christianity, about the culture wars, about church-state separation, you know, I obviously read a lot of atheist blogs and write a lot of it myself. I don't think people, if they just saw your writing on paper, they would think probably that you're an atheist yourself, because a lot of the perspectives you take, a lot of the views you have seem to fall in line with what usually a lot of atheists online tend to say. Do you get that reaction a lot? Like, are you really a Christian, or are you just an atheist in disguise on a Christian blog portal?
I I do get that a lot, not usually as a compliment, more usually as an accusation. But I think part of it just comes from I'm from a Baptist background, and you know, the separation of church and state is kind of a doctrinal issue for Baptists. Not that Baptists insist on any doctrinal issues. Baptists are sort of organized around the principle of not being organized. You know, we're not allowed to tell each other what to believe. But because, you know, from a Baptist point of view, I read a lot of atheist blogs and what is written there on separation of church and state. And to me, it's a great way of keeping up on stuff because, you know, there's only one Baptist Joint Committee writing about those issues, but I find so much more. And yes, when someone teaches the Bible in schools or puts up a sectarian monument with taxpayer money on public property, that's offensive to me.
And to bring up one point that you just mentioned, there is, and I believe it's called the Baptist Joint Committee, and they're awesome about church-state separation. Though I don't hear about them in the news very often, but that's not to be confused with some of the big Southern Baptist names that we tend to hear who seem to want every sort of merging of church and state that you could think of.
As long as it's their church.
Right.
Yeah, I think the Southern Baptists are eventually going to just have a pope, and you know they're increasingly un-Baptist in their polity. It's very un-Baptist to call someone an un-Baptist Baptist, but so I don't want to end up going there. But the Baptist Joint Committee is called the Joint Committee because it was sponsored by a bunch of different Baptist associations, including back in the day what used to be called the Northern Baptists, which are now just the American Baptists. And it used to be sponsored jointly by the Southern Baptists as well. But when the conservative takeover of the Southern Baptists happened, they stopped sponsoring that. Partly because the conservative takeover of Southern Baptists isn't really a fan of separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
How big is the, I don't know if tribe is the right word, but how big is the percentage maybe of people who tend to agree with you on these issues of church-state separation? I know coming from an atheist perspective, when I write about this stuff, it seems very rare to have Christians who say, yeah, I mean, you're wrong about the God thing, but I agree with you on the separation of church and state thing. I wish more of them said that, and I very rarely find those voices. I rarely hear them in my comments. You're one of the handful of people who seems to take that approach. Why is that?
It is rare. Although, you know, when I was an intern with the American Baptist denomination right out of college, and I went to the big Baptist biennial, which is their big every other year gathering, and they had one of these denominational fights over homosexuality at the time. And there were a lot of very conservative Baptist people there who thought, you know, what you would expect every very conservative person to believe about that. But because they were Baptist, they had, they would add, you know, but I can't impose my religious view on other people.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a very novel approach.
Unfortunately, it does. And it's a sort of dying out understanding of what it means to be Baptist, I think. It is odd. I think for a lot of people, it's not really so much religion, it's just the hegemony of the culture they grew up in, and they're just used to it. You know, when I worked at the Delaware newspaper, the one lower Delaware school district is just horrible. you know, it's a big Christian school that's the public school district, you know, that's how they think of it. So they just get upset when someone says, well, why are you praying before football games, you know? I think when they actually sort of drummed a Jewish family out of town when they tried to raise some of the stuff in court, I think they eventually won the case, but they moved out of town long before that. It was just intolerable, you know, to be living there anymore. But I think for a lot of people in that community, it just never occurred to them that someone thought differently than them.
And we still encounter that sort of mentality so many places today, that you can't see beyond your own culture, beyond your own belief system. That seems to be where so much of this conflict comes from.
Mm-hmm. And it's particularly weird with the Ten Commandments business, because, you know, there are so many different versions, sectarian differences in how do you number the Ten Commandments, how do you phrase them?
Right.
There is very much an evangelical Protestant formulation of the Ten Commandments, and there's a Catholic formulation, and there are Lutheran forms, you know, and all these different groups say, well, the Ten Commandments, who could object to that? You know, ignoring that the first half of them is utterly sectarian.
Right.
But it's, you know, just the process of choosing which Ten Commandments text you're going to publish means you're siding with one sect over against another sect. You know, so that this idea that they're just generically Christian, well, that never works.
Yeah, I agree. That's kind of a really I've always thought that was a short-sighted view of, like, people are trying to impose their religion into the schools or their local government, and I just feel like that's so short-sighted, especially if they're Baptist or some other, like, smaller sect of Christianity that, you know, what happens when everybody wants to do that? That's always been a...
Well, that's the fun part. Like, as we're taping this anyway, like, a school district in Florida said, oh, yeah, we'll allow a Bible giveaway from, like, I think the Gideons. And eventually they realized, oh, we have to open the door to all religious groups and atheist groups.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the Satanists said, we want in, they were like, maybe we should stop this altogether.
Yeah.
They can't see past, like, oh, they think only Christians are going to do it. And
right.
That's why they think it's okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what entirely, you know, I don't know if there's what degree of sincerity or anything, whether the Satanism that's doing this stuff is more
trying to prove a point
than, say, Pastafarianism.
Right.
But, because, I mean, the name Lucian Greaves, that's great. I wish I had written that name, you know. But the stunts they're doing are just fantastic at highlighting the hypocrisies and the dissonances of these things, you know. And that's something I've tried to – it's always tricky because when you're arguing against state-sponsored prayer in schools, and, you know, I sometimes want to say, well, what if there's a Muslim teacher who wants to lead the class in an Islamic prayer? Which is a hard thing, you know, because that will make most of the people who support prayer in school recoil in horror at the thought.
Right.
But I don't want to feed into an anti-Muslim thing there just
right.
to make that point.
I wonder when I hear these counter offers, not just Christianity in the schools or whatever, like, yes, the Satanists, I think, are proving a good point, regardless of how sincere they may or they may not be. I feel like, and here's a debate worth having or something, what would be more effective? Like a Satanist group coming in and saying, we want to do this, an atheist group coming in saying, we want to do this too, or having a Christian say, you know, I agree with the other Christians when it comes to the theology, but I disagree with them about what they are trying to do here, and here's why. And I feel like that voice would be far more effective than the outsider minority disliked group coming in and saying, we just want to do what all of you are doing. That has been effective at times, but I wonder if the Christian voice saying this is wrong, what we're trying to do here, I wonder if that would be even more effective, because you almost never hear that voice when it comes to these debates.
Mm-hmm. I think both appeal to different ways of hearing or get around defenses in different ways.
Yeah,
you know, there's a defense when you raise the church-state separation issue, there's a defense against it that just says, we don't have to listen to these people. They're atheists. They're them, you know. And that's one kind of way of shutting you out. But then I think, like, with that video response you just did for the Nines conference.
Yeah, yeah. I was asked for an evangelical Christian conference. They asked me if I wanted to make a video where I talk about my views on same-sex marriage, which surprised me at first, but I'm like, I'll say yes to this.
Yeah.
Here's my video. And they lived up to what they said they were going to do. I mean, they played it as part, it was an online conference. They included it in their live stream. And you know what the response I got from a lot of evangelicals who saw it as part, I don't know whether they were at church or they saw it at their in their basement or something. It was overwhelmingly positive, which was nice to see.
Did they chop it together so you're like, I love Jesus?
I feel like they could have done that if they wanted to, but they were very good about letting me say whatever I wanted. I think the only restriction they said is, please don't swear up a storm, some version of that. And otherwise, they were like, say whatever you want.
If anyone's a video editor, please, please find that video and chop it together for me.
I think I was impressed they asked.
You know, I was too.
And yeah. You know, I'm sure that eventually, you know, someday, years from now, God forbid, when you do die, that they will circulate stories that you had a deathbed conversion just before then. But in the meantime, I was impressed that they invited you to do it. But I think what you said in that will be heard. They're probably more receptive to that coming from you than they would have been coming from somebody like me or, say,
really?
Rachel Held Evans or someone. Because I think if say, Rachel had given much that same message, hey, you're losing young people to this.
Yeah.
The filter that we put on for that is, she's not really one of us.
I actually, that's funny.
Us, she's not really one of us. So there'd be a suspicion kept on her, whereas when you come in and say, hi, I'm not one of you.
And here's what I think.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I think that let them let some of that guard down. So I think what you said, I think you said it in a way that will be heard.
That's interesting. I actually had the opposite thought when I made that, which is that I'm glad they're letting me say this. I mean, here's what I have to say about it. I actually at first thought it would be more effective if it would come from someone like you or Rachel Held Evans, where, you know, you are part of the tribe, but you're saying that you guys wouldn't even be seen as part of the tribe. So it's easier to dismiss.
Yeah. Or I mean, one, you know, that's tribal language is a critique I make all the time, because I think it explains a lot. You know, one of the ways that tribes reinforce themselves is by policing that boundary.
Yeah.
Whereas you're just not. You're
I
not,
don't care.
There's no role for the tribal gatekeepers in evaluating you.
Right. What are you going to do? Right, kick me out of church? I dare you.
Right. It says it right there on the tin. This is the friendly atheist. So you're not. You know, it's sort of like the invincible ignorance from the Inquisition, you know. If you were a pagan, you couldn't be a heretic. So the Inquisition didn't have... It's sort of that dynamic a little bit.
Because you didn't leave anything?
Right, so you couldn't be in theological error. You were just in darkness. And,
right.
You know, you were going to hell, but you were a heretic.
But at least I'm not going to be burned beforehand.
Right. We didn't have to burn you at the stake and send you to hell. We just
You're welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
Your eternal fate. Yeah, and I mean, there is a difference there between the way I would have brought that message to them the way you did, which is that you were not just sarcastically celebrating
Yeah, I mean, in the video, I basically said, thank you for the way you've handled gay people, because it makes my job as an atheist a lot easier. That was the gist of what the video said.
Yeah. And I mean, you were wry about it, but you weren't kidding about that.
Oh, no, I'm totally serious. Like, I mean, we've made this point before that the way the church has handled the issue of homosexuality has done more for atheism than pretty much anything Richard Dawkins has done, Bill Maher has done, any of those people.
Actually, Fred, that brings me to
right
a question.
There with Ken Ham, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of...
Fred, Ken Ham sends a lot of people our
Ken
way.
Ken Ham is just an atheist manufacturing machine.
We should send him that, like, little button for Christmas.
Aw. Mm-hmm. I love that.
He is an assembly line I don't know.
No one understands him either. It's all right.
Fred, actually, that kind of brings me to a question.
By not using, by cautioning against excessive profanity. So I'm withdrawing from you.
You can swear if you want. We're all friends here.
Avoid the temptation.
So, Fred, I've been curious, and I've asked a couple of people on this show before, why did Christianity at large, especially in the U.S., why have they decided that the homosexuality thing is where they're going to plant their flag?
Why is that the big issue?
Right. Like, of all the things in the Bible, like, anybody who, has a cursory knowledge will point to the shellfish thing, and then you're not supposed to wear what?
Two types of fibers or whatever.
Like, and that's all in the same chunk of the Bible. So what is it, like, why the homosexuality thing? Like, why do you know why that's, like, the flag they plant there?
Why not say the prohibition against usury?
Right.
Yes.
Say, yeah, one of the things I sometimes argue is, hey, I'm not really asking you to interpret the Bible any differently. I'm just asking you to read the parts on sex the way you now read the parts on money.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But why this issue? One is part of the answer is it has become the substitute for the whole question of the authority of the Bible. It's a shorthand reference for how do you read the Bible, in the same way that young earth creation is used for a lot of people. Mm. It's not that they're particularly hung up on the age of the earth or something, but it's a symbol of a whole host of ways that you approach the Bible. Mm-hmm. Is it a plain literal meaning, and you consider that, the word of God? And so it's become this flashpoint because that's what it represents. It represents this whole other question of what does the Bible mean? How can, but that still doesn't answer the question of why that point?
Right.
Why not any of these other things? Mm-hmm. And, I think it's a whole host of things. I think it's, the ick factor, the ignorance, but I think a big chunk of it is probably that it's the one sin that we're safe to preach against, that if you're straight, you're not going to
fall for it.
Exactly.
Like, it's you can something cheat that on your wife.
It's
you
something
can...
that other people do. It's not something that you do per se.
Exactly. And it's not like, greed, lust, envy, wrath, pride. I'm tempted by all of those.
Right.
And if I make those the thing, then I might stumble on one of those and then get, caught. But I don't like guys.
Yeah.
So if I preach against that, it's perfectly safe.
Except for the number of priests who were later found who happen to like guys quite much.
Yeah, it turns out some of the people who are most vocal against it do have methinks they'd have to protest too much.
Yeah, right. Speaking of reasons to protest, though, let me bring this up. You've been doing, like, the longest book review in history, I think, because you began, like, a decade ago writing a review of all of the Tim LaHaye, Jerry Jenkins, I hope I got their names right, but all the Left Behind books. And you've been doing this, like, every book. And you're only on book three right now.
Wait, really?
Because, oh, yeah.
I am halfway through book three.
Because you only do these reviews a page or two at a time.
No,
you don't review
the
whole book. You review this page and what's wrong with this page. And you've been doing this forever. So, okay, so here's the question. You're halfway through book three. How long is this series going to go? Why that method? And what do you, I mean, are you going to compile these? Because I feel that would be a more interesting book than the Left Behind books.
Well, it's actually, it's longer than...
It's longer than the whole series already?
yeah, well, it's each review has been longer than the books that it's covered. I am working on putting those together as an ebook or something.
Excellent.
But it, I, you know, I went out, I grew up in a fundamentalist church and a fundamentalist private school where we read Hal Lindsey's books as a textbook in my school. You know, I took tests on this stuff. I studied those charts for credit. In high school,
we just saw the Nicolas Cage version of The Left Behind, the movie featuring Lincoln.
Did you see it?
It was 2 hours, and we can't take any more of it. And
it
you're doing
so
these
bad.
For years and years. Oh my God!
I can't wait till the next
but
one.
I think it was better than the book.
That is a sad.
The movie was so bad.
Because from what I can tell, they basically remade Airport 75 for the last half of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you know, the landing of the plane in the book itself happens off screen.
It's not even part of the series, really?
That's like the A-plot of the movie.
Chapter ends, the one chapter ends with Rayford saying it was going to be a tricky landing with the runway littered with fallen planes. And then the next chapter begins with them having landed the plane.
That's disappointing.
And he's basically going, phew, that was tough.
So you're saying the movie didn't exactly go from the source material as much.
The movie is an adaptation of a gripping action scene that was omitted in the book. but then the next scene in the book is our heroes walking across this tarmac covered with crashed airplanes and the wounded and the dying and trying to figure out how they're going to get back to the suburbs with all the highways closed, and they're just walking past these people, and it was scenes like that seeing something like that in print, and it was just jaw droppingly bad that made me, you know, I intended to buy the book, read a review based on the fact that I knew this Bible prophecy world pretty well. Uh-huh. But I couldn't get past
the first
some
page
of that stuff without and you know that's what blogging is. It's yelling at the TV
and hoping someone else is watching you reading you do that.
Yes, it's random.
What podcasting,
you know, it's some of us write from a place of joy or whatever. Others, you know, we're
a place
back
of frustration. Yeah. I've never heard of heard of movies that were badly adapted from the book. I've never heard of a movie that said it was based on the book, but it wasn't even based on something that happened really in the book.
Well, I mean, the
kind of
did land in the book. It's just we didn't get to see it. You don't get to see anything happen in the book.
You're telling me the daughter did not remove debris from the road using a tractor that she found on the side of the road.
She knew how to move so much heavy machinery.
In the book,
so good.
In the book, the daughter's just at Stanford when the rapture happens, and then a day later she shows up back in Illinois.
So women are represented. Congratulations, Left Behind movie.
Without any explanation as to how she got there, while at the same time that's interspersed with the story of how hard it is for Buck to get from Chicago to New York because there are no planes flying and all transportation has been shut down. And so it's literally like interspersed with how impossible it is to get around. And then Chloe shows up.
So really, we could make any movie. We could make any movie we want to and say it's based off of Left Behind.
I think.
Because we'll just say it was in the part that was omitted from the book.
Well, and so much of Chloe's trip from California to Illinois must be epic, but we don't know what happened.
Yeah.
Some of it is also just, I mean, I don't care if you're a premillennial dispensationalist Sunday or an atheist or, you know, what your perspective on life is, you ought to be able to get something. I mean, that whole mythology, that whole 20th century Fundy end times mythology stuff, I mean, that gave us The Omen. You know, that's a pretty good story. It ought to be exciting. Certainly the end of the world ought to be exciting. There's, you know, demon locusts with heads of lions and stuff.
What's worse, the plot or the writing?
It's the thing about these books that has kept me going is, I mean, they fail on every level. The theology's bad, the writing's bad, they are more deathly misogynist than I expected.
That's impressive.
They're just, it's like everything.
Is it sad that nothing. They have sold more of those books than anything any one of us will ever write?
Hey, I haven't written my book yet, so let's take it easy.
Well, there you go. There you go. Fingers crossed.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I think it's...
Left Behind is like jazz. Again, it's all about the pages
whole,
you don't write.
You know, but I think it's partly because the audience, it's a captive audience. You know, in 1995, when that first one came out, there wasn't a lot of fiction that those people were allowed to read.
A captive audience in more ways than one.
Oh. Well, those poor saps don't have Harry Potter to read, so what are they going to do with their life? It's a shame.
Yeah, I don't get to not allowed Harry Potter. We were allowed Narnia, you know?
Yeah.
That's pretty Christian, though.
And that's got magic and wands and
stuff. Yeah, but Jesus is a lion.
Well, I mean, it's a clumsy allegory, but it's still got all that magic stuff. So is Harry Potter once you got to book 7. Did I spoil that? Okay.
Spoilers.
It's okay.
Spoilers for Harry Potter, guys. No, actually, I grew up reading the Narnia series, and I did not get the Christian themes until I was much older than I should have been. Like, I was in college, and I was like, okay, I get
That's
it.
That's what that was
there
about.
There it is. It clicked. I was a dumb kid, I guess.
The first one is really, is very much, you know, just your basic sort of Christ story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From a particular view of the atonement or whatever. But still, that's very straightforward. But the second book in the series is really kind of a tract against Christian legalism. Because, I think a big chunk of Prince Caspian is C.S. Lewis thumbing his nose at American Christians, because evangelicals love C.S. Lewis. He did not, but it's an unrequited love. He, they bothered him because, you know, they didn't drink beer, among other things. And he did quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And and the whole second book of the Narnia thing is all about these, you know, these strict people who come in and chase away all the wild things and outlaw all the, you know, wild, true Narnia that has to... I mean, at the end of the book, Bacchus is the first wild thing to return, and it tears down the bridges with vines to grow grapes to make wine.
Attaboy.
So, there you go.
We'd be
so
friends.
I was reading that in my funny school thinking, did I say Bacchus? Do you know what's in here? But I don't think they did either. I think they just gave us permission because it was C.S. Lewis and therefore, you know, good.
Yeah.
Things like that got me through quite a bit.
Let me ask you, as a critic of a lot of this stuff, as a critic of the church, do you see it changing from the inside at all?
Well, you know, yes. But also, it's just, it's, there's so many different strains and strands and flavors and traditions that you know, it's so sometimes it's hard to tell whether, oh, is this a change in the church, or have I just wandered over into a different park, you know? It seems like an awful lot of the former evangelicals, at least the ones who write online, are Episcopalian now.
Yeah.
I'm not Episcopalian. I'm just an expatriate in the Episcopal Church.
We have a couple last questions for you. One of them is just, what impact at some point, I'm sure, in the near future, same-sex marriage will be legal across the nation? I mean, I feel like that's going to happen sooner rather than later. What effect is that going to have on the church that maybe we're not seeing right now?
I think a lot of people are going to, you know, come out, you know, Dave Gushy just wrote a book in, 2014, endorsing same-sex marriage. And it's getting denounced right now. I think 30 years from now, some of the people who are denouncing it now are going to point back to it and say, well, look, no, we were approving of this. Christian Voices, you know, it'll be like there were some fantastic Christian abolitionists.
Yeah.
In the antebellum U.S. Some really amazing people, just heroes. But they were a minority of the church.
Right.
And a minority of white America. And yet when the church or white America looks back to that period, you know, we're always with Las Casas and not with Columbus. We're always with John Woolman and not with John Calhoun.
Yeah,
you know,
big fears of what's going to happen, which is that the church is going to say, "Hey, gay marriage is legalized. We made this happen."
No,
they're not going to ever admit that they were the obstacle for it happening. They're going to say, "Yeah, we're the we finally began embracing it, and then we pushed it over the finish line." They're going to find a way to take credit for this at some point in the future. It's going to happen
in our lifetime.
In our lifetime, they will start taking credit for the push for gay marriage somehow.
Well, I don't know how fast, but I'm cynical enough to say yes, eventually. But I'm with Jeff on in our lifetime, maybe not quite our lifetime.
Eventually,
but down the road. Yeah.
But do you think, like, historically, they're going to be like, oh, well, you know, we came around. So, like, in textbooks 100 years, they're not going to have textbooks. And whatever they use 100 years from now, is that you think in our lifetime?
Well, 100 years from now, you'll be able to read, like, Southern Baptist writings talking about, you know, Bishop Gene Robinson as though he were a Southern Baptist and not someone they had vilified for decades.
They're going to start embracing all these pastors that are like, oh yeah, gay marriage is great, and they're heretics right now, but they're going to love them later.
But here's the thing, is we have record, like for the first time in history, we have record for every shitty thing.
We have all the video of Jerry Falwell, have videos
like
of
there's
Robertson.
No hiding from that. Like, yes, you can whitewash it as much as you can, but there's no hiding from it. We have records. That's like if I came out as a Christian and it was like, oh, I was never an atheist. They've got hundreds of blog posts I read. They're like, are you sure? Do you want to check that over? You know, I don't know.
It's there, but the other interesting question, ramifications of that change is what happens to the current insistence that those dozen, not even a dozen, those six or seven Bible verses that are right now the crux of Christianity. You know,
the clobber verses.
Yeah, what happens to the fact that right now we're saying they must, and obviously, and can only be interpreted in this way, in 30 years when we're all reading them that way, what will we make of that? And that's what really mystifies me, because You know, and this is one of the things I've been reading a lot about is Mark Knoll's work on the Civil War and some other Carolyn DuPont's stuff on the Civil Rights Movement. And you see these theological disputes, you know, what does the Bible say about slavery? Well, that fight, that argument never got settled. You know, it got settled by other means.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we look back on it, we all agree with the abolitionist interpretation, but none of their arguments won. And
a lot of revisionist history coming up.
The clobber text for slavery just disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we read them the way we read these verses on homosexuality, we would have to say, hey, we're wrong to get rid of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Or some such. And eventually, hopefully, we will come to... I mean, there was a counter-argument, of course, that says, no. Look, there is this stuff in the Bible. Here's another way of looking at it. But that argument never won. What won was General Grant.
Right.
You know? And I don't know what will happen to the clobber text in 20 years. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, you know, Fred, this is a lot of fun, but we have to wrap up. We can find you where?
I am at the Slacktivist blog on Papios.
We will provide a link along with this.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And where can I direct people to find that?
That's a great question. once we figure out a home for this podcast, we're going to let you know. It's one of the many things on a list of things we really should have done about 3 months ago. I don't know.
We're nailing this.
Yeah, we're nailing it.
All right.
So Fred Clark, he's a Slacktivist on the Patheos Network, and we'll provide a link for that. Fred, thanks so much for your time. Always fun talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks. It was fun. Thanks very much for having me. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. This episode was taped at Cinnamon Sound Studios in Aurora, Illinois, and the music was written and performed by Brad Chagdis. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at patreon.com/Hemant. That's He-Man T. We appreciate your support. I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blumke. We hope you'll join us next time.